Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Often, when people think of Tibetan Buddhism, they have a limited vision of that social reality, perhaps one that imagines monks sitting in meditation or focused on the Dalai Lama. Rarely is the historical role of female Buddhist masters central to one's understanding of contemporary Tibetan life. In Love Letters from Golok, a tantric couple in modern Tibet, Holly Gailey centers women's leadership through an introduction to the important tantric master Tara Lamo. Through an examination of hagiographic literature, the personal letters between Tara Lamo and her husband Namchul Rinpoche, and field research, Gailey offers an in-depth study of the role of Buddhism in revitalization of Tibetan culture and identity in the post-Maoist period. Central to her analysis is understanding how hagiography aids in healing cultural trauma brought on by the minority policies of the Chinese Communist Party and the brutal years of the Cultural Revolution. The reframing of historical events fosters cultural revival in Tibet, envisioned through a Buddhist lens. In contrast to the lofty images presented in biographies, the 56 letters exchanged between Tara Lamo and Namchul Rinpoche offer a personal self-narration of their relationship, which is steeped in tantric imagery, Tibetan folk genres, and Buddhist cosmology. In our conversation, we discuss the Nyingma Buddhist tradition, the effects of the Maoist period on Tibetans, forms of agency, ethnographic accounts of ritual ceremonies, female religious authority, revelatory texts and treasure teachings during degenerate times, contemporary preservation of their teachings through multimedia sources, the couple's activities within the community, and Tara Lamo's legacy today. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Holly Gailey about her wonderful new book, Love Letters from Golok, A Tantric Couple in Modern Tibet, published with Columbia University Press in 2016.
Welcome, Holly. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here, Christian.
Yeah. So Love Letters from Golok was a really wonderful book. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to talking about the project. We always start here at New Books in Religion a little bit about our authors, though. So can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the study of religion, perhaps moments or mentors that have been influential in shaping the subjects you're interested in, the topics you explore? How did you end up where you are?
Well, I have to say I got into the study of Tibetan Buddhism really through travel. So I took a year off during college and traveled to India, and also after college saved up money and went back to Asia and spent time. Actually got really attracted to sort of Himalayan regions and traveled from Darjeeling to Dharamsala, and stayed really close to Tibetan Buddhist communities. So that was the really beginning of my interest in both Buddhism and studying the Tibetan language. And I did my MA at Naropa university and fell in love with translating Tibetan texts. And so applied for PhD at Harvard at the time when Janet Gyatso was just in the process of being hired. And so she's been an indelible influence on me. And I think I started getting interested in studying the revelatory tradition of Terma or Tibetan treasures due to her influence. And actually, the subject of my book, Love Letters from Golok, a Tantric Couple in Modern Tibet, Khondro Tare Lhamo, the protagonist of the book, we started to read her biography or Namtar in a Tibetan class. And I asked her, I was sort of in that class with other students who were all men, and I said, you know, can I work on this? And nobody had discovered her yet. And I went to Golok that year, 2004, and wanted to retrieve the entirety of her collected works with her partner, Namchul Rinpoche. There was a partial collection at the Tibetan Buddhist Resource Center, a wonderful online source that the late E. Jean Smith had created. It's an incredible treasure trove of Tibetan literature that he has preserved digitally. And so I went to retrieve the rest of their corpus and met Namchul Rinpoche. Khondro Tare Lhamo had passed away, and he gave me their entire corpus and this extra volume addendum, which was their letters. And somehow, you know, her Namtar is fairly brief. Actually, most of her life story takes place in Namchul Rinpoche's Namtar or biography. Namtar means a story of complete liberation. I use hagiography in the book because it's a third person kind of hagiographic account of their life. You know, I wasn't sure that that would make a dissertation, but when I got those letters and he told me about how they were exchanged at the cusp of right after the Cultural Revolution, so at the cusp of liberalization in across China, in both the political, economic, and religious spheres, I got really excited. And the letters that I brought back, it was a facsimile edition, were quite challenging to go through. They're all almost entirely in verse. And the poetic styles, I really at that point knew nothing about. And but it was so exciting because, you know, it's really the first collection of love letters to come to light. And, you know, as I waded through them, I saw how many complex and rich kind of dimensions were included in there, a kind of prophetic dimension about their role in cultural revitalization and in the region of Golok and beyond, but also this personal affection that they developed across their correspondence. So that's really what set me on my way.
Yeah. It's amazing to kind of hear the story and to read it in your account, because it really does seem like such a wonderful set of accidents that happen in terms of bringing you to the project, because it really explores the subject of Tare Lhamo in such fascinating ways. And I think probably for many listeners, when they think of Tibetan Buddhism, they think of men and monks specifically. So perhaps to kind of help us enter into the project, what do people need to know a little bit about the Nyingma tradition, more specifically about recent Tibetan history during the kind of time period you're working on?
Well, first, let me just say Tibetans have a conception for such accidents, and it's called auspicious coincidence or tashi tendril. So so it was a wonderful kind of circumstances coming together. And I think actually a lot of scholarship comes out of such coincidences. And it's certainly an important theme for them in their writings. The Nyingma tradition, I think the important thing to note there is that because those teachings or those lineages are passed oftentimes through the family, And it allows a cultural space for female tantric masters that is not available in more monasticized traditions. Now, over time, the Nyingma tradition also became monasticized, but the lineage holders are still very often through the family, and even reincarnation schemes, which are used elsewhere in Tibetan Buddhism, in the Gelug tradition with the Dalai Lamas or the line of Karmapas, there's umpteen reincarnate lamas, you know, associated with various monasteries and lineages. That was really that whole Tulku tradition, or the tradition of reincarnate lamas, was instigated to resolve the problem of monastic succession and how lineages pass in the absence of family traditions. But in the Nyingma and the Sakya, it's really, and those lineages trace their histories all the way back to the early propagation of Buddhism in Tibet in the imperial period, 7th to 9th century, when Tibet was this vast empire. You know, those traditions that have a family succession, I think, have more space for female roles. Certainly the female members of the traditions are often really well-trained and included in esoteric teachings. I think Khandra Tare Lamo's rise to prominence is in some sense an accident, again, or a coincidence of history, to the extent that, so she grew up and was trained before really the socialist transformation of Tibetan areas was underway. So she was born in 1938. She received an esoteric training from the great masters of her day. Golok was a thriving center for the Nyingma tradition and for the revelation of terma, or treasures. And she was deeply embedded in that as the daughter of a well-known Tertön, or treasure revealer, in her region. So, and she had three brothers who were all reincarnate lamas. She herself was recognized as the reincarnation of two figures, proximate in time and place, one male and one female. And though in the late 1950s, after the People's Liberation Army had come into Tibetan areas, and originally, of course, they had promised a kind of gradual transformation of those minority areas where they had initially a sensitivity to preserving their culture. And that sort of shifted, and they decided to accelerate the socialist transformation in those areas in the late 1950s. That meant the imprisonment of a lot of religious and political leaders. And so her three brothers were all imprisoned. Her first husband was imprisoned, and they died in prison in the late 50s, early 1960s. So a whole generation really was lost. And Namcha Rinpoche was 6 years her junior, so who had become her second husband. So he was too young at that point to be considered a leader or a threat of any kind. So he became the secretary of his work unit. And Khandra Tare Lamo, I think because she was a woman, was also spared. And she remained really important to her local community, even though she was forced to work as an ordinary herder and be part of hard labor, building, you know, construction projects, et cetera, that other nomads and Tibetans were engaged in. And then, it wasn't until after the death of Mao and the end of the Cultural Revolution that the possibility of revitalizing Buddhism and other kind of aspects of Tibetan culture was possible. So the whole period from the late 1950s to the late 1970s, really the public observance of religion was prohibited, I mean, with some exceptions. So it's really a story of the kind of suppression of the tradition and then this incredible opportunity to revitalize it. And she and Namcha Rinpoche were really leaders in that process in the region of Golok.
Now, part of what you're doing in the book is bringing in these kind of very different types of sources to understand how female authority is being kind of narrated and how Tibetan traditions are being revitalized and kind of re-narrated in new ways. And you begin with one text called Spiraling Vine of Faith, which is one of these biographies of Tare Lomo. Can you tell us what's going on with this text? In what ways is female religious authority asserted within it? And then how we might understand it within kind of the larger context of Tibetan literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Spiraling Vine of Faith is the liberation story of Tare Lomo. And what's really interesting and struck me on the first reading that we did in that class, and actually we never got to Tare Lomo's own story, which is quite interesting because the first half of her biography is really a rehearsal of female antecedents who she is understood to be an emanation of. So the most famous would be Yeshe Tsogyal, a central figure to the lore of the imperial period, again, that 7th and 19th century, the advent of Buddhism in Tibet. And then a more approximate figure is Sarah Kondro, who was a renowned female master of the previous generation. And so those biographies are actually, sections of those biographies are included in Spiraling Vine of Faith. And you don't get to Kondro Tare Lomo's story until halfway through. So that to me was already a really interesting kind of problem of, you know, why is it necessary to have this long preamble? And I theorize that that's really important to establishing her religious authority, that there's a kind of that in general, in this revelatory tradition of terma or treasure revelation, there usually is some rehearsal of previous lives, some list of previous lives to validate the religious authority of these figures who are basically revealing texts that have the status of scripture in the Nyingma tradition. But in her case, it's much longer than is normal. Usually that takes just a few pages, a list of figures, some prophecies from well-known other kind of contemporaneous religious figures, and then they move into the life story of the master. So you know, I make a case that although in actuality, in the sense of thinking about the social terms in which she gains religious authority, it's really through family, through being the daughter of a well-known religious figure and being able to then be recognized early in life and receive this early esoteric training. But in terms of this, so that's in terms of the social system, but in terms of the symbolic system, she still needs a kind of place in that. And that's achieved through these past lives that she's considered an emanation of, and also through evoking the category of the Dakini, which is a class of female tantric deities. And so through past lives and through a kind of homology to, in her case, Vajrayogini and Sarasvati and other female tantric deities, that she's then has a sort of placeholder in the symbolic system. And so both of those, I argue, in chapter one, where I really go into Spiraling Vine of Faith and female religious authority, both of those, I argue, sort of create a cultural space for her to later in life then be an important religious figure.
Now, in the next chapter, you kind of focus more broadly on kind of the role of hagiography in healing this cultural trauma that Tibetans have gone through, almost as a site for an alternative narration of Tibetan identity and history. So how does Buddhism serve as a kind of new interpretive framework for understanding cultural trauma? And why would authors want to do this, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so chapter two is really where I make an argument about the genre of hagiography, in particular in the post-Mao era, and talk about a kind of collusion between self-censorship, so not wanting to say anything controversial given the sensitivity of the Tibet question, and then the sort of traditional norms of hagiography, which are focused on you know, religious figures, and especially when narrated in the third person, quite miraculous in nature, and emphasizing their ritual activities and really not focused on the kind of quotidian, the sort of elements of daily life, in which then the social realities, especially of the really devastating period, two decades between the late 1950s and late 1970s, those are completely set in the background. So, you know, what I argue that this allows, especially for the narration of her life during that time through a series of miracle tales, is to really recenter the telling of history on Buddhist masters. So to recenter it with Tibetans as the agents of their own history. And so this is a kind of intervention in or building on Dipesh Chakrabarti's work on minority voices and subaltern agency, where he talks about the writing of history, you know, from a minority point of view, by which he means both marginalized populations, but also minority in terms of epistemic frameworks. So for him in particular, he evokes religious frameworks. So how does the subaltern assert agency when often religious frameworks kind of put the credit on some transcendent, you know, forces that are operating within history? So I take up that problematic and think about Buddhist ways to narrate history and the creation of a Buddhist framework in which then lives are and Tibetan history is narrated. So I do that in this chapter in terms of thinking of cultural trauma, and then I do it again in chapter four when I look at the kind of prophetic framework in which their letters envision their life together. And in there, I talk really about healing the damage done to Buddhism and Tibetans. And in chapter two, I focus more on what it means to sort of have a miracle story set in a period. Miracles presume a kind of superhuman agency on the part of a saint, in this case, Khandro Thare Lhamo. And of course, that's outside of the epistemic framework of history. But what it allows is a kind of triumphant Tibetan agency in the midst of the devastation, and also a kind of reassurance that even though so many great masters died, that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas never abandoned the Tibetan people. They worked in their midst in these very localized ways.
Now, in the middle of the book, you move from these biographies or hagiographies to these personal letters, which are really fascinating. I mean, it seems like such a find that you were able to look at these. So you have these 56 letters exchanged over, you know, about a 3-year period. What types of literary strategies did these couples use to negotiate the terms of their union in these letters? And how did they narrate their relationship, you know, in this kind of, I guess, across multiple lifetimes or generations as they kind of placed it within these communications?
Yeah. So first of all, they lived in two separate counties, which were across province borders. So her in Pema County in Qinghai Province, him in Sertab County in Sichuan Province. Those areas used to be very much because they're part of the same neighborhood and or neighboring regions, and also part of a kind of unified cultural region, if you will. So Thare Lhamo's family had traversed that whole area in her youth, and also the broader area of Golok. But because of the province boundaries and because travel was restricted at that time, they actually only got to meet once during a little over a year-long period of their correspondence, when Namcho Rinpoche surreptitiously made his way across that border to visit her and meet her relatives. So what's really exciting about the letters is that the bulk of their courtship takes place And the letters were secretly exchanged. They had a messenger who, you know, went by horseback between them. The letters were batched. That, of course, leads to the complication of not knowing exactly the sequence of them. I've had to reconstruct that. So we have the collection of his letters and the collection of her letters. But oftentimes in Tibetan literature, when you have the letters of a great master, you only have one side of the correspondence. You have the letters of that Buddhist master preserved, but you don't know who the interlocutors are often. Or if you know who they are and you can identify them, you don't know what was contained in their side of the correspondence. So here we have both sides of the correspondence, even though we can't sort of match them exactly chronologically. I was able to reconstruct that sequence in broad strokes. And what's contained in there is just really incredible. I mean, you have on the one hand, this sort of prophetic strain, their own articulation of aspiring to heal the damage to Buddhism and sentient beings, meaning Tibetans in their region, after this period of devastation. So they only sort of refer to the devastation of the Maoist period obliquely as degenerate times. And what they're appropriating is a long-standing kind of narrative framework that's particular to the Nyingma tradition and to Terma or treasure revelation, which is that there are sort of these periods of decline in the Buddhist teachings. And then that calls forth the necessity of fresh revelations traced back to the advent of Buddhism in Tibet, figures like Padmasambhava and Yeshe Sogyal. And those teachings are understood to be embedded in the Tibetan and Himalayan landscape and also in the minds of particular predestined disciples who become tertons or treasure revealers. So both Namcha Rinpoche and Tare Lamo trace their past lives all the way back to the 8th century as direct disciples of Padmasambhava. For Khandra Tare Lamo, that's Yeshe Sogyal. For Namcha Rinpoche, that's Namkhon Nyingpo. And he was recognized in his youth as the fourth emanation of Namkhon Nyingpo of his monastery, Dzogchen Monastery in Serta. So those are publicly recognized identities, and so they borrow this longstanding narrative to be able to narrate or situate their own prophetic destiny at their historic moment at the end of the Maoist period. And so then the revelation of Terma, because these teachings have been hidden in the sort of depths of their minds, they use tantric practices of sexual union in order to be able to access the depth of mind. And this is throughout the treasure tradition, which began, you know, in the 11th century, traced all the way back to the 11th century of Tibetan history. So it requires a kind of tantric partnership, but usually it's the male who gets credited with the revelations and the female partner is in a more supportive role. And in this case, their whole corpus of revelations is jointly attributed, and they took turns, you know, later in life, once they were united in 1980, recalling the symbolic sort of either seed syllables or lines of symbolic script that trigger the memory of the revelation. So they took turns discovering that and decoding that. And so very much a partnership. But in the letters themselves, there's this prophetic aspect. There's also these tantalizing then sexual innuendos drawing on tantric code. There's also the blossoming of their personal affection, and they use the whole thing is almost entirely in verse, and some of it's quite formal and prophetic, and others they break into, you know, local love song style. So it's really animated, and part of what I argue, at least in chapter three, is that there's a kind of romantic love, as sociologist Anthony Giddens talks about it, where they're not only is there tremendous affection, but there's a kind of mutual narrative of being uniquely compatible, And they do that both in prophetic and personal terms. So some of their love songs, which are drawing in folk song styles, will talk about how they're inseparable, not just across lives through, you know, their past life genealogy, but as a mountain lion and its or a snow lion and its mountain perch, or like a gold-eyed fish and a turquoise lake, or like the tigress and its jungle habitat. So it uses all these kind of folk metaphors for love and companionship. And what's so wonderful about that is it really humanizes them. So their namtar, or stories of complete liberation, their hagiographies, are narrated by, in the third person, by a devoted disciple and historian. So they're very elevated in those. But the letters give us this incredible window into them, the more human side of their relationship, their emotions, but also the way that in chapter four, I sort of discuss how they view their historic moment and the kind of contingency, even within the sort of prophetic vision that they're destined to be together and they're destined to reveal these terma, it's still the coincidence. So here we come back to this term, auspicious coincidence. The coincidence, the causes and conditions have to come together in order for them to be able to reveal their treasures or terma, their esoteric teachings and ritual practices that will help revitalize Buddhism in Golok. So there's very much a sense of their uncertainty, their mutual support, their gaining of confidence, their the way that actually their love starts to allow the memory, this sort of visionary memory, to unfold. And usually that's understood to happen through these sexual tantric practices. So that's something really unique in the letters, that it's actually love and their affection that enables the memory process and the visionary process to start to unfold. So there's really a lot in the letters. They're complex, they're dense, and they're really delightful to read. I'm actually preparing a translation of them for publication. Should be within the next year that they come out.
That's great. Yeah. As a reader, especially somebody who's not a Tibetanologist or anything like that, it was really helpful to kind of see them in contrast to the hagiographies. It really kind of drew out the unique nature of both types of literary genres. And towards the end of the book, you return to another hagiography called The Jewel Garland, which is a post-1980s account of the couple's lives. What's going on with this text? How does this account narrate the activities they're doing with the community?
Yeah, so Jewel Garland is actually the complete liberation of Namtro Rinpoche. So it's his hagiography. And the two of them, Spiraling Vine of Faith and Jewel Garland, actually were published together in a single text. The reason I place it later is because their activities together as a couple are actually embedded in his hagiography. So this is part of the complexity of Khandra Chare Lamo's life story as it unfolds, because on the one hand, you have her youth and her religious training and her miracle tales during the Cultural Revolution and period years leading up to it, all in her own hagiography. And then at about the age of 40, it just stops and says, well, the rest of her life can be found in Jewel Garland. So really her religious activities in their public expression are found in his life story. And this is something really unique, because Jewel Garland, it contains the story of Namtro Rinpoche's youth. But those are only the first 20 pages of a more than 100-page hagiography. So the bulk of his life story is their life story as a couple. So they operate as joint protagonists. There's about 20 pages that introduces her into his life story. There are excerpts of the letters. There are prophecies. So it's really it makes a really big deal about her entrance into his life. And she was quite prominent. I argue more prominent than he was at the time. But But partnering with him enabled her to be a much more public figure, because usually these chondromas, these sort of socially recognized female figures who are seen by their communities to be realized or enlightened, usually they lead very kind of quiet lives. They might give esoteric teachings to small groups of people, but they don't travel monastery to monastery, sitting on the high thrones, presiding over rituals with, you know, thousands of people. That's very, very rare. So her kind of uniting with Namcha Rinpoche allowed her to play a much more public role. And so chapter 5, which looks at the hagiography of cultural revitalization, is really thinking about how is that narrated with a tantric couple at the center of the kind of narration. And so I draw on Charlene Makeley's work, where she talks about this sort of post-Mao era as a remondalization process, where basically in her case, she's talking about an area much farther north, Labrang Monastery in Omdo, and the kind of masculine alliances between Buddhist monastic hierarchs and Tibetan tribal leaders, and how they kind of together have reconstituted these sort of masculine alliances, and she focuses on a particular ritual that contains in it a kind of subjugation ritual. So it's really a lot about masculinity and violence, and as a ritual metaphor. And in this case, you know, we have the unique situation of a tantric couple who traveled and taught side by side on elevated thrones and presided over large scale rituals. So at the center of the mandala, or the sacred circle, mandalas, you know, we know here in the in North America, you know, people are familiar with sand mandalas, these intricate drawings. Artwork that's made out of little grains of sand that monks put together. Those are really two-dimensional representations of a three-dimensional palace of a deity, and then the deity is the inhabitant of that particular mandala. And oftentimes that's a deity in union with consort. And so here you have the kind of iconography of Yabyun, which is male and female deities in union, that is so central to Tibetan ritual and iconography and artwork. And you have that actualized in this couple. And rather than a kind of metaphor of subjugation, they use the metaphor of healing. So in their letters and also in the Namtar. And this is something that you see more broadly of contemporary Namta or hagiography. They're using a traditional genre, but there's some very unique features. So I mentioned the sort of way that history is being narrated. They also say that the purpose now is not just to engender faith, but to heal faith. Debas soa. So there's a sense of the needing for healing. And they do that in Jewel Garland through reestablishing people connections and place connections. So the notion of reestablishing connectivity between people and places through their revelations and through their ritual activity is kind of the central way that their lives together, traveling and teaching during the 1980s and 90s, is narrated. And David Germano from University of Virginia has actually talked about how the treasure tradition, or the Terma tradition in the region of Golok, one of the reasons it's been so vibrant is that it has this ability to reconnect, or what he calls remember, the dismembered landscape of Tibet. So there's a way that the sort of visionary ability to reactivate pilgrimage sites, to introduce, you know, new scriptures or hitherto unknown scriptures, but that have this sort of ancient pedigree. All of these things are ways, you know, to as those teachings are given, or as those pilgrimages are undertaken, basically Tibetan communities are reconstituted with Buddhist masters at the center of the mandala. So that's the sort of argument that I make vis-a-vis Jewel Garland as a hagiography.
Now, you also tell us a little bit about the later life of the couple. Tara Lomo dies in the early 2000s. Her husband dies in, I think, 2011. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the kind of their later role within the community, and then perhaps a little bit about the legacy of this woman and this couple within the region?
Yeah, so their Namtar basically go up until 1996. It's published in 1997. And so I had asked Namtar Rinpoche on several occasions if he could narrate for me the end of Tare Lamo's life. And he sort of put me off for a while. And then it's traditional, actually, in Buddhist texts, you always hear of people asking once, twice, and the third time is sort of the magical, you know, now or never moment. And so it was the third time I asked him, and he said, well, I don't really remember. And I thought, oh, you know, that's a sort of polite way of saying, you know, sorry, I don't have time or something. And then he started to, but he kept going. He said, you know, we just did the same old things. We went to the same series of monasteries. So they had this group of monasteries in the region that they went to and visited and did rituals at and gave money to and helped support the monastic populations, help with rebuilding projects. They were quite involved regionally. And we're teachers to the lamas at those monasteries. So he said, we just went to the same places again and again. And then, you know, we got tired and people started to come more to Nyenlong and their home monastery in Serta. And so there's not much to say. And I was almost going to give up until I noticed that when his attendant was actually getting out these astrological charts for those years. And I realized, like, oh, he's going to consult the records. And it gave me this incredible insight into the hagiographic process, because they consult these astrological charts, which are now made in kind of these paperback forms that they flip through to find auspicious days to hold ritual occasions. But they also then record in there what they've done. And so they become this record that can be consulted for the later reconstruction of their lives. So I kind of, you know, and Pema Isoltai, who's the one who composed Spiraling Vine of Faith and Jewel Garland in association with a government agency that he worked for, you know, he told me that they mainly were the ones who gave him the narrative. And then he also consulted elders in the region. So, and I did the same. I actually sort of, you know, I consulted their Namtar. I interviewed Namtar Rinpoche many times, but I also traveled throughout Golok trying to collect stories of Khandra Tare Lamo. So in some ways I was sort of unwittingly replicating in a kind of imperfect way as an outsider, the hagiographic process. Once he got out those charts, you know, he did sort of say the main teachings they gave each year. But then really what was amazing was the narration of her, you know, her final years. And then there's also a text that he had given me the first time I met him. That's her last testament that he composed based on her final hours. So those two together are quite a touching account of, you know, seeing signs of her death. Again, the way that, you know, unfortunate circumstances are narrated is really, really interesting. And the way they use karma to explain that. And there's a lot of prophecy wrapped in that, that there was a prophecy she'd encounter a certain number of obstacles in her life, but the last one couldn't be overcome. And it's a way to sort of reconcile oneself to, you know, uncontrollable circumstances. So, and then the other thing, though, in that chapter, which is really the epilogue, is this beautiful final letter that that has been taken out in the republishing of their collection of letters in paperback form, which I find really interesting. But it's the final letter in the original collection he gave me, a facsimile edition. And it was written on the year anniversary of her death. And again, in really human terms, Namcha Rinpoche just, you know, shows himself as, you know, in the depth of anguish and sorrow and tears cascading in a constant stream and being distraught and audibly wailing, alas, and, you know, and just, you know, really grieving her absence. And then her appearing in a vision to assert once again their inseparability. And so there's this sort of, you know, there's a couple things going on there. There's their separation early on across province borders, and yet they were asserting their inseparability across lifetimes and the power of their karma and destiny to bring them back together. And then here, after her death, again, she's in his recollection or of this vision, she is actually saying once again that they're inseparable. And he told me that. He said, she's with me all the time. Every time I'm teaching, she's by my side. And I happen to have the passage right here. It's really beautiful. In this vision, she says, even when separated in the manner of relative appearances, in the definitive truth, fundamentally, we've never been apart. From your indestructible original mind beyond measure, I didn't go anywhere. There is nowhere else for me to go. So this beautiful sense of being inseparable, you know, even after death. And I have to say, he really kept her legacy alive. You know, he all the kind of audiovisual materials. Buddhist monasteries are producing a lot of audiovisual materials with songs of devotion and pop songs, and some of them include their advice. Some of them are written by monastics, even lamas. And, you know, all in posters and amulets, it's always the two of them as a couple depicted. And, well, you know, all the way until his death. And then in the transition to his son as the lineage holder, then I started to see pictures of Namcha Rinpoche and his son, which is a real shift. But while Namcha Rinpoche was alive, it was always him together with Tare Lamo as he would speak. So when he narrated the last years of their lives, he would say, we too did this and that, and even the dream of us too. So they're sort of, again, like joint protagonists in his own narration of their lives. And of course, they created this beautiful reliquary to her that was there in a special shrine room in the family compound after he passed away. So she passed away in 2002. After he passed away in 2011, there was an identically sized, you know, designed reliquary put in the same room and connected by special cords. And so this sense of them being inseparable in that way. What's interesting about her legacy is that her reincarnation at this point seems to be in exile, whereas Namcha Rinpoche's reincarnation actually has taken place within the family of his son, Tulku Laksam, who is identified as the reincarnation of Tare Lamo's own son from her first marriage, who died actually in the mid-1970s. So there's this really interesting way that they kind of try to join family streams through reincarnation schemas. But it means that her reincarnation, you know, may or may not be a lineage holder of their teachings, but certainly his reincarnation as Tulku Laksam's son will be the main lineage holder. And I should mention that Tulku Laksam had 7 children, 6 daughters. They kept trying. The 7th was a son, and he was almost immediately recognized as the reincarnation of his grandfather. Hmm.
It's an amazing story, and it sounds like there's a lot more work to be done, and maybe not all by you, but it sounds like there's a lot more. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you are working on now?
Sure. So As I mentioned, I just completed the translation of their hagiographies and letters, select letters. I chose about 2/3 of them. Some of the denser prophetic ones I omitted. And those are going to be coming out in a book called Inseparable Across Lifetimes, The Lives and Letters of the Tibetan Visionaries, Namtcha Rinpoche and Khandra Tare Lamo, through Shambhala Publications, so a popular Buddhist press, so that they can be available kind of more widely. And so I have an introduction in there that summarizes their context. But really, I wanted to make available this amazing source material. And then I also have an article coming out in an edited volume by Karma Lecce Somo on Buddhist feminisms and femininity, where I look at three different biographies of Khandra Tare Lamo and compare how they characterize her in gendered terms. So really thinking about male clerical authors who are writing about female visionaries. And there's a lot of overlaps in kind of literary strategies, actually, with the writing of female saints in Christian history. So I draw on some of that scholarship to make some points, but really think about geography and the sort of social location of these various male cleric biographers of her life. Parallel to this project on Khandra Tare Lamo and Namtcha Rinpoche, I've been working pretty much all along on a Buddhist ecumenical institute called Larang Buddhist Academy, or Larangar, which is quite internationally well known, and looking at works of advice to the laity by its founder, Kenpo Jigme Punsok, and some of his successors like Kenpo Tsuchun Lojo and Kenpo Riktar, who's also written about Tare Lamo. So I've been really interested in especially Buddhist ethics and how that interweaves with cultural revitalization efforts. So I have several articles that have been in Journal of Buddhist Ethics, Journal of Religious Ethics, Contemporary Buddhism, Himalaya Journal, but also a new one coming out in the Oxford Handbook of Buddhist Ethics on Contemporary Buddhist Ethics in Contemporary Tibet. And so that, for the general reader, that might be of interest because it gives a kind of broad overview. And now I'm getting interested in, you know, other projects. Dujum Lingpa, who is a predecessor of Tare Lamo in Golok, also part of this stream of Tibetan treasure revelation. He's the progenitor of a lineage that Tare Lamo married into. Her root teacher was his grandson, an emanation. So I'm starting to get interested in his songs of advice to female disciples and trying to just recover a broader social history in that area. And we'll see where that goes and what other journeys I might make. I'm also really interested in the transnational transmission of Tibetan Buddhism to North America and Europe, and translation issues, both translation of literary genres and translation, cultural translation. So I co-edited with Joshua Shapiro a book of translations called A Gathering of Brilliant Moons, Practice Advice from the Rime Masters of Tibet. So looking at the genre of Shaldam, which is works of advice, in this case on meditation rather than ethics, And you know, how do we translate specific genres to capture their special qualities so that we're not just consumed with a kind of scholastic producing literal translations, but we're really starting to get sophisticated enough to treat Tibetan literature as literature and start to distinguish between different genres of poetry or verse or song and different styles of writings like Shaldam advice literature or other more colloquial expressions.
Sounds like you've been very busy and some important challenges you're tackling. So thank you for your work, Holly, and thanks for taking the time to talk about your wonderful book here.
Thanks, Christian, for having me. Really enjoyed our time together.
That was my conversation with Holly Gailey about her wonderful new book, Love Letters from Golok, a Tantric Couple in Modern Tibet, published with Columbia University Press in 2016. Thanks for listening to another episode of New Books in Religion.